in today's episode.
And had you been trying to email other people? Or no, was he the first person?
What had happened was that in November 2012, I ended up going home. I ended up watching Jiro Dreams of Sushi with my wife. I said, yeah. What a great idea. It was like 1 a.m. in the morning. And so my wife said, don't get any crazy ideas. So the next day I went into work and I was thinking about it. And I found him. I found him on Facebook. But I still wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? I said, let me take a shot. I wrote him an email with Google Translate. And I told him what I did, what I wanted to do, and I left my number beneath it. I get a phone call after 2 weeks. It's him.
That's crazy. This is Bilal Zaidi, and you're listening to Creator Lab, where I learn how to turn ideas into action. I'll bring you conversations with leading entrepreneurs, nonprofit founders, award-winning designers, educators, artists, and everything else in between. We dig deep into their stories, have honest conversations about how they made their ideas come to life, and the lessons learned along the way. This episode is sponsored by The Square Foot. It's the simplest way to find office space. They have a beautiful website where you can transparently browse places by size, by neighborhood, and by price. They'll then pair you up with a salaried broker, so someone who's not incentivized just to rush you into a lease for their own benefit. They are incredibly transparent, and there are hundreds of companies like Breva, Instacart, and Casper who have already used their services. Please check them out on thesquarefoot.com/creatorlab today. Hello, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So for anyone who hasn't heard of Sushi Nakazawa or yourself, could you just explain kind of where you are today, what the restaurant's about and where it kind of started?
Well, Sushi Nakazawa is a sushi-only restaurant, which is located in the West Village. And my partner is Daisuke Nakazawa. If you're not familiar with Daisuke Nakazawa, he was the senior apprentice at Injiro Dreams of Sushi. And I am the owner of that restaurant alongside with him.
That's cool. So how long have you guys been around now?
It's been we're going into our fourth year.
So just to give people a sense of scale, whatever you're able to share in terms of the business itself, you've got this one particular restaurant, and previously you had some others as well, or you had family businesses?
Correct. I was partners with my family. We run Italian eateries throughout New York City and a couple others in, you know, out of the state and so on. But as we're growing now, you know, our locations are in Brooklyn, Staten Island, the Bronx. We're opening multiple ones now, and, you know, we're working on a new project now around the block from Nakazawa. And we're constantly growing. You know, there's a couple new surprises coming up that I can't speak about, but you'll definitely hear about. Yeah, you'll definitely hear about them.
Okay, cool. So how many are there in total now?
In total, we're looking around in the vicinity of 10.
10. That's amazing. Yeah. Cool. And you're 37, you said.
I'm 37. I'm turning 37.
Hope you don't mind me talking my age.
No, it's totally fine. I feel like I'm 67. All right. But 37.
But 37, you started pretty young, right? Like I read that you started when you were 13 in...
I started when I was 13. That doesn't mean I was fully, you know, eloped into into the restaurant business. But my dad used to take me up. We had opened up our first restaurant back in 1993, and so I would go up with them. Then throughout the summers, I would end up working, you know, throughout the whole summer with them, and I just fell in love with it.
Well, what did you fall in love with? Was it the food or just the business? What?
Well, I didn't start like everyone else. I wasn't as fortunate. My dad was really hard on me, and I started by cleaning everything, cleaning the pots and pans. And I really did start from that first level, and I started working up. And the more I learned, the more I appreciated it. So, you know, my favorite when, you know, the summer, when the summer was there was me ended up, I ended up getting stuck in the kitchen, and I used to love to cook, and I continued to learn from them, and it was a great experience.
And were both your parents Italian?
Both of my parents are Italian.
Were they like Italian American, or did they come from
Italy?
No,
they're Italian. Oh, I'm first generation Italian.
So they've got like the accent?
Not really. My dad came here. My dad came here in the late 50s. He was just a couple years old. My mother came here when she was about 16 years old, and she came here in the 70s. In the 70s. So my mother has a little bit of an accent, but my dad he's actually more American than me.
Oh, yeah. So what was that like growing up in that household? Did you have brothers and sisters too?
I did. I have three other siblings. I have two other brothers and a sister. It was fun. It was, you know, we grew up in a neighborhood in Brooklyn, which was called Bensonhurst. We lived in a one-bedroom apartment. With at that time, there was only three of us. It was three boys, and I remember clear
like
as
we said, only three.
Yeah, no, it was. Yeah, you know, my sister came later on.
Yeah,
you know, she came in late. But I remember growing up, we grew up in this Italian-American neighborhood. We used to live right alongside of my grandparents. So my parents used to rent the apartment right alongside of them. We used to live in this one-bedroom apartment. I remember sleeping in, remember the couches that used to pull out?
Yeah.
And me and my three brothers used to be there, and my mother used to have the bedroom with my father.
All
so,
right.
But it was a great experience.
Yeah. So then, so you were 13, it sounds like, when you first started with the family business. And your what sort, it was like Italian, was it like pizza or pasta? Like what?
It was pizza and pasta. And then we started developing it a little bit more. And, you know, the first location was up in the Morris Park section of the Bronx, which wasn't, you know, they were accustomed to having classic Italian American fare. And, you know, us that we would go to Italy on an annual basis, we started bringing back ideas, and we started bringing back, you know, different things that they were having in Italy. And we really did change how that neighborhood actually looked at Italian food.
Well, whereabouts in Italy were they from?
My parents, my mother was Neapolitan from Napoli, and my dad Sicilian.
But okay.
I'm more Neapolitan, so I tend to go to Naples a little
okay,
bit.
Okay, cool. So for people that have never been to either of those places, what, because I know a little bit from my Italian friends, but Sicily specifically has quite a different culture than the rest of Italy, from my understanding.
Yeah, Sicily is an absolute beautiful place. The weather is always magnificent. Where my dad came from is a coastal area, which was called Portambedico. It's in the province of Agrigento. My mother is from a city, which is Naples City, right in the heart of the city. And it's a little bit more chaotic, a little bit more diverse. It's basically like saying you live in New York City or you live in upstate New York.
Okay, all right. Which one's upstate New York?
Upstate New York is Sicily.
Just to clarify.
Or Long Island, I should say.
All right, cool. So you said you were cooking directly, so you learned to cook pretty young. And then what else, what other sort of jobs did you do in the kitchen, in the restaurant?
I always... I did everything. And then, you know, I took a liking to the dining room and I ended up staying in the dining room. But in the interim of everything, I didn't think that the restaurant business is, I had a love for it, but I didn't think it was what I was going to do.
What did you think you were going to do?
I was going to be a lawyer.
Oh,
something
really?
Different, maybe an accountant, you know? And,
I'm trying to think of you as an accountant.
Yeah, it just... But I think it's all destiny more than anything. What you plan on doing is not necessarily what you end up doing.
Yeah. So would you say your parents, were they, would you say they were more working middle class or like, how would you?
They were definitely working middle class.
Okay.
They were hardworking people. My dad is actually still, you know, now that my parents, everyone has grown up, my dad's still at the restaurant. He does all the baking on a daily basis.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
That's
so he's
cool.
Still there and he enjoys it and he's always working.
We can't
get him out of there.
Are you close to your dad?
I am. I'm close with all my family.
Okay, great.
I'm family oriented.
So I didn't ask this, but are you the youngest, eldest?
I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest. Okay.
I'm the oldest.
So you did. How was that relationship with your younger siblings? Were you kind of like a second father figure, or were you just kind of one of the boys? How was that?
Me and my brothers are very close. I think we're a tight knit. We're a tight knit little group. I think from the way that we were raised, the environment that we were raised in. We're just, every little thing that we do, we think about each other. If
okay.
we're thinking about going to a game, the first person I think about is going with my brother.
So what about your mom? You didn't mention your mom that much just now,
no,
but I've heard you mention her before.
My mom is a great, very, very strong woman. She's definitely that mother, you know, that staple in the family that that binded everything together. She's, once again, everything that you would want to ask for out of a mother.
Okay, cool. So, you know, we're going to get to some fun stories about how you ended up starting this restaurant specifically. But what were some of the things that you learned at that age that you apply on a day-to-day basis or, you know, in the future when you set up these other restaurants?
Right.
Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, of course. I think the first thing, we were always hungry. You got to be hungry. And you can't just be satisfied. And you got to continue to thrive and you got to continue to want more. And even though that we did extremely well, and even though it was an amazing chance that we were taking to myself getting involved in something that I wasn't really familiar with, which was Japanese food. And, you know, when I spoke about it, everyone thought I was crazy for doing it.
Yeah.
But once again, my philosophy has always been that I could almost do anything.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So that kind of brings us to
the genesis of, you know, starting Sushi Nakazawa specifically. So give us a sort of time period when that was. It was 4 years ago, you said, but you know, what time of year was it and how did this happen?
I can remember it was the winter time that I actually emailed him. Mm. I think it was November.
Okay.
In November of 2012.
And had you been trying to email other people?
Or was he the first person? What had happened was that in November 2012, I ended up going home. I ended up watching Jiro Dreams of Sushi with my wife. I said, yeah, what a great idea. It was like 1 a.m. in the morning. And so my wife said, don't get any crazy ideas. So the next day I went into work and I was thinking about it. And I found him. I found him on Facebook. But I still wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? I said, let me take a shot. I wrote him an email with Google Translate. And I told him what I did, what I wanted to do, and I left my number beneath it. I get a phone call after 2 weeks. It's him.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So he turned.
Did he ever tell you how the Google Translate worked? Was it? I mean, it probably wasn't.
I definitely butchered the Japanese language, but it worked. It was sufficient enough. It was to where he understood exactly the message that I was trying to get across. Yeah.
So, and at this point, he was in Seattle, right?
I didn't know that either.
He had already moved from Japan.
Right.
And also, just for people that haven't heard of Jiro Dreams of Sushi or watched it, first of all, please go watch it. It's an amazing documentary. But could you just explain what the documentary is a little bit and the significance of the guy, Jiro himself?
Right. Well, Jiro is to be the most amazing sushi chef at this time. He's a elderly man. He's 90 years old. He still continues to work. His store was in the Ginza train station. But what was really beautiful about it, about the whole documentary, is about how minimalistic and how beautiful and how devoted he was to the art of making sushi. And that's where I took tremendous passion in, and that's what I loved. And that's why I'm here at this point.
Yeah, and the chef that you're now working with, Chef Nakazawa, he was one of his like proteges, I guess.
Right. He was there 11 years.
11 years. So there's a famous scene in the documentary where he finally makes the egg. Is it an omelet? I don't know.
Yeah, it's an egg custard omelet.
Custard
basically.
Omelet. And you guys serve that here, right?
Well, we do serve it.
So yeah, just look out for that part in the movie if you watch it, because it's pretty epic. So that's cool. So, you know, knowing how different the Japanese culture is to the American culture and Italian-American or Italian culture, how have you been able to build some of those bridges with him? And have you seen any similarities?
No, I did. At the very beginning, it was a little tough. You know, there was a language barrier. But now that, you know, he's been here a little bit more, he's becoming a little bit more Americanized, which is a good and bad thing, of course, like anything else, you know. So you lose some of the old traditions, but I think he's trying to, you know, keep the most important ones. But life in America and how we do business is totally different. Mm. So I think he's adjusting and adapting to it.
So what can you think of some examples where you've noticed how different it is?
Yeah, it's tremendously different. I do, you know, now we do business on a handshake. Before, we had to get to know each other for about 6 months before we could even do anything.
Okay.
You know, when I first had met him, it was definitely a journey to getting to the, you know, to the point of deciding to open with me and making that decision. You know, it's the Japanese way. They want to know what you do as a pastime. They want to know about your family. And so on.
So let's go back to that moment where you messaged him on Facebook. He called you up, and then what happened from there? Did he just turned up in New York? Or
no, he thought I was crazy. but once again, you know, when a stranger is calling you and they're telling you that they would like to do something with you, and it was a big chance on me, because at the end of the day, I really, you know, it was a shot that I was taking, but he was also taking a shot. He was a father of four, and when you have a family, it's a little tough to trust anyone. But so he thought I was crazy, and I flew him in from Seattle. You know, he started at a hotel. He flew him in Seattle. I got him a translator, and that's where we started.
Okay. And how long did he stay on that trip?
2 days.
Do you remember what you guys did?
2 days.
Took him to Central Park?
No. Central Park. I think he went shopping for his wife that morning. No, when he got in, he went shopping for his wife. He bought his wife a bag. And then after that, you know, we went out to dinner. We spoke about a couple things. We got acquainted more than anything. Mm. I wanted to put a face to that, to my voice that we had on the phone. And it was very important that I did that.
Yeah. And then what happened? How did you progress that relationship from a weekend to a full on?
Well, we continued with Google Translate.
Okay.
And we continue with Google Translate, and we continue to speak on a daily basis. And then he came back, and we started, you know, really chit-chatting about ideas and things that he had and what he wanted to do. And hopefully we were on the same page, which we were. And it made sense to him, and it made sense to me. And
What were some of the concerns he had in the beginning? Do you remember?
One of the biggest concerns is always, I think, trust, you know, considering that I'm definitely, he was new to the States and he was only here for 3 months. And plus, I am a stranger and I'm definitely not Japanese.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a little difficult to, you know, he was so used to dealing with things in that type of realm that this was all new to him. And for me to earn his trust was a very important fact, and it took a little bit of time.
So from that first email to on Facebook to actually opening, how long did that take?
6 to 8 months.
Do you remember that actual moment where he agreed, and what was it that, what was the deciding factor?
Well, the deciding factor was that he had thought about everything for his children.
Yeah.
Listen, I think it's key. I think where it made sense is everyone wants a better future. And what was in store for him here was definitely something that we didn't know what was going to happen, but it was a shot worth taking. And I think he decided that, and he went forward with it.
What happens now from your side? Because you've been in the restaurant game, you've already got several restaurants. What does it actually take to open a restaurant in a city like New York?
Well, not any restaurant. We're speaking about a restaurant that just does sushi. So it was a little bit more difficult than that. And, you know, when Nakazawa told me, he goes, I only want to do sushi. I said, wow, I think you're crazy. But, you know, I think we need to do a little bit more than sushi. And he's like, no. I said, fine. You know what? Let me trust in you. I said, but at the end of the day, I did a whole bunch of due diligence and research. And I looked into, I must have eaten at 200 different Japanese restaurants in order to get a really good idea. And the one thing that I wanted to do, the only, that we wanted to change is Nakazawa is a very special place. Why is it special? Are we doing amazing sushi? Absolutely. Nakazawa does a fantastic job. But what we offer is on the dining side, we don't do Japanese service. What I brought to the table was a different, you know, an aspect of fine dining, an aspect of a very westernized type of service, which a Japanese restaurant didn't do that. And when we decided to design the restaurant, we didn't want it to be traditional Japanese. We wanted to think out of the box.
Yeah.
And if you look at the dining room that you're sitting in at the moment, does this look Japanese to you?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, we've got our shoes on.
Yeah. Well, no, but besides not having shoes, you're in New York City, I don't think you would want to take off your shoes.
Yeah. That's true.
But we wanted to make it elegant, but we wanted it to be minimalistic and simple at the same time. And I think we achieved it.
And what about location? How did you think about where you wanted to open up?
Well, location was ideal. We knew that we didn't need, you know, we number one, a restaurant such as this wouldn't have to be on Fifth Avenue. It definitely was a destination.
Yeah.
And when we scouted out different locations and we came across this one in the West Village, which is on Commerce Street, as you know, it's basically the most, it's the prettiest little block.
Yeah, it's beautiful, yeah.
Commerce is only two blocks long, but it's a stunning block. And we loved the neighborhood and it just fit. It was just perfect and you knew it.
So say I wanted to open, let's just say, so my family is originally Pakistani. I'm born and brought up in London, but we're Pakistani. So we love food just the way Italians do, right? Say I wanted to open a Pakistani restaurant or Indian restaurant in New York. What would be the thought process if you were attacking that with me? What would you be thinking? So let's start from like, say, high end versus mid-tier. What was the thought process around something?
All right,
like
so
that?
The thought process,
yeah,
the way I think.
Yeah, the way you think.
All right, the first thing that we need to really establish is we need to get a chef.
Yeah.
And we need to figure out what kind of chef, what kind of food that we're doing, and then build everything around that.
Around the chef, okay. So with Nakazawa, you decided it needed to be high end. Or high end. Would you count it as high end?
I didn't decide to. You know, sushi is a very... The type of cuisine is very specific. Absolutely. You can have sushi that is, you know, sushi, you get what you pay for. You know, opening up a sushi restaurant is very different from opening up a regular restaurant. We're not buying chicken. We're buying the best bluefin tuna that we could find.
Yeah.
We're buying the best, the best golden eye snapper that we could find, the freshest scallop that we could get. So it's a totally different playing field. So,
and had you done that before? Because you're Italian, all the other restaurants are Italian, right?
I did, but I did it on a different scale.
Okay.
And I never did it on this scale. And I must say that I did learn a tremendous amount of information from staying with Nakazawa.
In what way?
You know, I didn't know how a sushi restaurant worked. I didn't know about the type of fish that they would be serving in the omakase.
Yeah.
You know, being American, being Italian, we're not accustomed to eating red cornet fish that looks like a monster.
Yeah.
You know, well, we're definitely not. But I learned, and I started understanding why. And I started understanding why this piece would be going into the omakase, why it would be going, and why it made sense, more importantly.
Yeah. Okay. So you've got your chef, you've got your location. What's the process look like to setting up a menu and really just saying, okay, that's exactly what we want? How long does that take, and what was the process like?
Well, the menu was created by Nakazawa, but we all spoke about the way we created the menu was we had in mind that we wanted to create a sake pairing. And we believe that we are the first people to create that sake pairing. And there was no other restaurant that did it before us. And in order to do that, if you, I'm sure you eat out in sushi restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, when they start the omakase, they start with random pieces. It's whatever the chef feels that he wants to do. Mm. Ours is very, very organized.
Yeah.
So it was easy for us to pair with wines or sakes or whatever, you know, the choice may have been if you wanted to do sparkling wine.
Yeah.
We start with the lightest piece of fish going into the heaviest.
Okay. So there's a lot about sequencing and the full
The experience. Sequencing was the most important factor. Yeah. Yeah. You know, if you go to Masa, which I love Masa, right? Yeah. They start you off with a piece of Otoro. Mm. We don't do that here in Nakazawa.
What about, you talked about how you guys have now built some trust up and you now have got a good working relationships in any business, any relationship, whether that's with a business partner or your wife or whoever, there's always disputes. So how do you guys manage disputes, especially with the difference in culture?
I think I wouldn't call it disputes. I would call them that maybe perhaps we don't agree on the same thing that we're speaking about for
difference
that day.
Difference of an opinion.
But it's give and take. It's like a marriage.
Yeah.
You may not like some of the things that your wife has to say, but you live with them and you get through it. And you know what? Yeah. You find out some of the times that she's actually right.
Yeah. All right. So it's just on a case-by-case basis.
It's case-by-case. And I think being a partner, I think it's really on both ends. Really hearing each other out and then coming to a decision that we both could agree on.
Yeah. So then let's take it to launch day. When was that and what was that day like?
On launch day, it was the most important. It was the most important and it was the most exciting.
Okay.
It was the most exciting. I'll tell you why. Because we didn't know exactly when we were launching Sushi Nakazawa, we launched it a couple of weeks before. Before opening the date. So we put, you know, we said that reservations would be going online. And if anyone had any interest of making a reservation at Sushi Nakazawa, you know, put your information in, how many, and so on.
Yeah.
That one day when we went to check, that first day that we actually ended up putting reservations up, we had 3,500 requests.
No way. Wait, so is this on the website or an open to what?
It was on the website. And they would
so people just filled out like a form, or?
Basically almost like a form. They would, you know, name, phone number, email address, how many in the party, and how many we were taking.
And what's
3,500 requests
for the first day? That's first day. Ridiculous. So what's the capacity here? How many could you fit?
Not 3,500. We see 10 at the bar,
okay,
and another 30 in the dining room.
And what? So in that time, what had you guys been doing to build up buzz?
Well, I think the buzz was already there. I think it was the perfect time. We were at the perfect place and the perfect timing. Mm. You know, Jiro Dreams of Sushi had just came out. And it was really a great time for Nakazawa to prove the last 11 years that he worked at Jiro, what he could do.
Yeah. So specifically, though, did you guys end up reaching out to press or press reached out to you?
Like, no, but we basically, it all came naturally. It all came naturally. I think the first person that we did get in touch with was, I think it was the Times.
Okay, so this is before it opened.
Correct. It was a one-sentence blurb about us opening, and then everyone else picked up on it.
And then, so you open. What was the actual opening day like? I know there were plenty of people that wanted to be here. How did that feel for you after all that work?
Well, opening day was probably one of the most stressful days that I've ever experienced.
Yeah.
You know, having it, not knowing exactly, I did what I would do in an Italian or a French restaurant, and I gave that type of service.
Okay.
Opening day, did minimum seating at the bar. The bar, instead of doing three turns, we only did two turns, and then we allocated just a couple tables in the dining room, just to really, you know, get used to what was going on and start, you know, learning and going from there.
Did you run any practice? Like, I've never done this before, so before the actual launch day, I assume you've had people here before to like serve your friends or something, family or something?
We didn't do family and friends.
You didn't?
We didn't do family and friends.
The day that you opened was the first time you ever did that?
The day that we opened was the first day of service.
Is that normal?
No, not really.
Why did you do that then?
Not really. Because you know what? We were actually on a time frame.
Okay.
We needed to open. And we were already delayed. We had to open in July. We ended up opening at the end of August.
Okay, so it was there was time pressure.
Correct.
To okay.
Correct.
Okay.
But the people that we went out and sorted out and hired,
yeah,
that we took in, knew everything that they needed to know about this business. So it's about hiring. It definitely is about hiring great people.
Yeah, that brings up a good point. So obviously the chef is, you know, one of the most important parts of the whole setup. What else goes into a restaurant like this?
You know? What goes into a good restaurant like this is, besides the chef choosing his second in command, third in command, and having great people to work with that have experience and that know what they're doing, on the other side with service, from the minute you call and make a reservation to the minute you walk out, everything has to be perfect. And we had to basically set all that up, and we went looking for that.
Mm.
You know, Sushi Nakazawa is great now because it's easy for us to pluck great employees, and It's a lot easier finding it. You know, someone
now,
would
4
like,
years in.
Absolutely. You know, who doesn't want to work at Sushi Nakazawa?
Yeah.
If you love Japanese food.
Yeah.
So it's a lot easier for us to have great people. But at the very beginning, it was all up to us to go out there and really poach the best. And basically,
how did that? So were there just people you knew from your time in the industry? Or?
Basically, it was people that I had relationships with.
Okay.
Friends that I had relationships with.
Yeah.
Them reaching out to other friends and so on and so on.
So how many people work here now? On a typical night, how many people are part of this operation?
On a typical night, we have about 30 people in this small little location.
That's crazy. Okay. That's interesting. All right. So you've had a successful launch. It sounds like stressful, but successful. Mm. How long is it until this famous New York Times 4-star review happens? How many months was that?
December.
So what was it, 4 or 5 months?
3 months.
3 months, okay. And again, for people that aren't in the food world or whatever it might be, could you just explain the significance of the New York Times review? Is it Pete Wells?
It is Pete Wells. And, you know, Pete Wells is probably one of the toughest critics that the New York Times ever got as a food critic.
Yeah.
So we definitely nervous, but we were on top of a game. So at the end of the day, as nervous as we were about getting reviewed, and we knew that we were going to get reviewed, we were on top of our game. So that, you know, we knew that we were doing the right thing.
Mm.
But getting a New York Times review and getting 2 stars is amazing.
Yeah.
2 stars
is
amazing. And if you get 3, I can't tell you, but getting 4.
Yeah. What's it out of? Is it out of?
It's out of 4.
Out of 4.
Out of 4.
Yeah.
And that is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And no one ever thought that we didn't think that we were getting 4 stars.
Yeah. So what, just do you remember that day? Like, did you know he's coming, or do they randomly come? Do they have to tell you?
Well, they
coming?
Randomly come. We didn't know that he was coming. We don't know the days that he came in.
Oh, you don't actually
even
know?
No, we don't.
Oh,
we don't know the days that he came in. But we do know that he probably sat at the bar and he sat in the dining room and he got both experiences.
Mm.
And, you know, what happens is on the review, you get ready for the review because the Times calls you, says you're getting reviewed. We need to come take pictures.
Mm.
And that's how you know that the review is coming out.
But they don't tell you when.
But they don't tell you when the food critic is coming into you.
Okay,
that would defeat the purpose. Yeah, don't you think?
So I'm not Pete Wells, but I've eaten here that one time and it was as good as any experience I've had. So
thank you.
Definitely, I'm, you know, I don't know as much, but it was definitely great.
I'm happy you enjoyed it.
Once that happens, what happened after that with the 4-star review? Did you just see the profile of the restaurant just go crazy? Or what?
The profile, you know, there was a tremendous boost in the profile of the restaurant. There was a tremendous, it just changes your life. It changes everything about the restaurant.
Mm.
But the most important thing that people do forget is when you get 4 stars, you definitely need to be consistent.
Yeah.
Because there's only one way you could go. You could go only down. So that's another part that also stresses us out. But, you know, we continue to basically be innovative on what we do. We try to better the restaurant on a daily basis.
Yeah.
We have multiple meetings on a daily basis and we speak about how we can improve it. We do it with the kitchen and we do it with the dining room.
And in terms of marketing, right? Because my background is in marketing and I help brands market things better to generally sell more products. Right. It's very different in the restaurant world. So how do you guys see the role of marketing, and what is marketing to you?
Well, I think the product sells itself, but the role of marketing, like that young lady that you're looking at right now, she plays a tremendous role. I think what she does is we always keep the restaurant relevant, and that's very important.
Okay.
You don't want to be forgotten.
Could you give an example of how you keep it relevant?
We redesigned the restaurant on a annual basis.
Okay.
We just added a beautiful lounge area to the restaurant.
Okay, I don't think that was here when I
Yeah, that definitely wasn't there.
Okay.
That wasn't there. And we continue to add. And so, you know, we're always on everyone's mind. So today they say, oh my God, did you see what they did to the dining room? Did you know that they added a lounge?
Yeah.
Did you see the beautiful glassware that they added? Do you see what's going on?
Yeah.
We go from there. Okay.
And also, I know that the chef has talked about creating a new category. I've heard him mention that in the past, and maybe you've mentioned that as well. I think it was on Eater or something.
A new category.
Well, he said he didn't want it just to be kind of what you said before. It's not just traditional.
It's New York Mai.
Okay. Oh, there we go. Yeah. All right.
He calls it New York Mai. I know exactly what you're speaking about. It's not the most traditional form.
Yeah.
Once again, if we would create a classic edamame style sushi restaurant as you would get at Jiro, Tsugabashi Jiro, I don't think you would be content and happy.
Mm.
How do you feel about walking into a space that you're paying $300 and having a 30-minute meal?
Yeah.
And only having beer?
Yeah.
So the great thing about Nakazawa was he actually spent a little bit of time in Seattle, and being in Seattle, he got to understand exactly what America, you know, what people in America wanted.
Yeah.
And he mixed that with what he learned at Jiro for 11 years.
Okay.
So it's a, you know, it's a collaboration of what he learned in Seattle and what he learned in Japan. Japan.
And so even when I had the fish, there was just different flavors. Like, I don't even know how to describe the flavors.
Well, each piece of nigiri that we tend to give should have its own, you know, flavor profiles. Mm. Everything should be different. If everything tasted the same, that's not exciting.
Even different to sushi I've had elsewhere. And I had it June last year on my birthday, and I'd just gone to Japan a couple months before, and I thought the best sushi I ever had was in Japan. And then when I got here, I was like, I'm not going to find sushi like that here, right?
I appreciate that.
But then, this was definitely, and I'll say, the Japan was still like basically 10 out of 10, but this was up there too. So
thank you.
But it was very different. So anyway, so it's interesting how he's innovated in his own way as well, in terms of the menu.
You know, there's too many times that we go to a sushi restaurant, we're at the bar and everything tastes the same.
Yeah.
It tastes like mush, or it tastes like, basically slimy fish.
Yeah.
But what Nakazawa does is really amazing, from the texture to the temperature.
Yeah. Well, you've probably spoken to him about this, but what does, he worked with Jiro for so many years, and the attention to detail that he's probably been trained to have is probably just on another level from most chefs, I'm sure.
It is. It was instilled in him.
Yeah. And have you seen him? Have you seen that in action here? Like, even just the process of him making the sushi? Were there certain things you noticed when he did that?
I think what was instilled in him and the ability to pay attention to the closest little details. But the only thing that does make him different from being at Jiro's is his personality.
Yeah.
More than anything. The only thing that he never liked about working there was the seriousness of it. He's serious about work. He's serious about providing the best piece of nigiri that he possibly can. Mm. But what he wanted to do was he wanted to have fun doing it.
Yeah.
And I can't blame him for that.
It seems like even just from when I saw him when I was there that night, he was kind of smiling and interacting with people more than it looked like in the documentary anyway. In the documentary, it was very straight-faced.
Yeah, I'd be afraid to speak to, in front of Jiro. No, but I think that's what makes it great, because it definitely is a stage.
Mm.
You're at the sushi bar, you're having dinner, you're looking at him, and it would be kind of sad that if you had a chef that was really, really serious, said two words, would make you feel uncomfortable. But Nakazawa has a warmth that is like no other.
A lot of people that listen to this are interested in business as a whole, and even myself, I might not ever open a restaurant one day, but I'm always interested to compare it to other businesses. So again, whatever you're able to share here as a rough benchmark, But opening a restaurant in, let's say, lower Manhattan, if I needed to benchmark around the sort of money that I need to get in place, whether that's savings or going to a bank or whatever it might be, typically, what is the range that people are going to have to start with?
That's a very tough question. Yeah. It's all depending on exactly what your concept is and how big the concept is. If you were opening up a taqueria,
yeah,
you wouldn't need as much money as you
or
would
a
need to open
cart.
Up right, or a halal cart. Yeah. You wouldn't need as much money as to open up a Nakazawa.
Okay. So let's say, and you don't have to give Nakazawa specifically, but if you're happy to share, then great. But something like this.
I think most restaurants.
Yeah.
So I could answer your question. I think most people that open up a restaurant from scratch, white box,
yeah,
are spending anywhere from $500,000 to $750,000.
$750,000, okay.
To do it decent.
Yeah. And if we were to go into a little bit more detail of what that entails, so is the bulk of that, I guess, lease for the place, I assume? It would depend on...
No, you always have your security deposit, but that's why I tell restaurateurs, and what we look for now is we don't look for white boxes. We don't want a white box. A white box is a headache.
A white box meaning a blank slate sort of thing.
Just you walk into the space, it's a white square.
Okay, literally. Okay.
Nothing in there. We want, you know, we like spaces that used to be a restaurant. It's a lot
some
easier
history,
for us.
Yeah.
Because you got to remember, New York City is a really, really tough place to do business in.
Yeah.
Besides, you got the DOB, which is the Department of Buildings.
Yeah.
Besides the filing, besides the State Liquor Authority, besides the community boards, there's a lot that you need to go through in order to get that restaurant open.
Yeah.
And it's not as easy as it used to be.
Yeah. And why do you think that is? Why has it become harder?
Well, I think New York City has changed. I think New York City in the next couple of years will be a museum. And what I mean by a museum is it'll be amazingly expensive and no one will be able to afford to open up a business to make a living in.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the questions I had actually, as New York is changing in the future with rates going up, rent going up, etc., is anyone going to be able to open a restaurant?
I don't know. I truly don't know. You know, we don't own the space that we're at Sushi Nakazawa, but there's little things that you look at. You look at taxes that you're responsible for. And you got the taxes going up. You got you got employment costs going up. Mm. There's so many different factors in a business that take really place. You know, like the changes from tip employees at a $5 tip employee to $7.50. That is a tremendous, tremendous difference.
Is that the minimum wage?
The minimum wage on a tip employee used to be $5.
Used to be
$7.50.
Okay.
And on a restaurant that's actually busy, that can mean $100,000 easy on an annual basis. So all these things factor in.
So that's great to have those benchmarks of $500 and $7.50 even as an example. What are the other costs people might not even think about? Obviously, there's rates. The employees, the actual food. Is there anything
so many,
else?
There's so many hidden costs.
Yeah.
There's so many hidden, you know, there's so many different hidden costs. I've experienced this in almost every restaurant that we say. We say 500, 750, let's say 100,000.
Mm.
I tend to go over budget on almost every restaurant. Why do I tend to go over budget? Unfortunately, I don't like building trash.
Okay.
I build, the products that I build is, I build quality restaurants.
Yeah.
And, you know, I walk in, I say, oh my God, look at this chair.
Don't like it. Yeah,
I wouldn't want to sit here.
Yeah,
let's change it.
Where did that come from?
I don't know.
Because you, like you said, you grew up in a pretty working class.
Yeah, sometimes it's poison. Sometimes it's poison because you can't live with certain things, and you need to make them different.
Do you remember when that happened though? Because as a kid, say you were 13, 14 with a working class background, you probably weren't like that then.
Yeah, but I you know what? I appreciated everything.
You
then,
appreciate it, okay.
I think where that comes along is probably, I wouldn't say I'm a perfectionist.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone is perfect, but I try to come as close as I can. And what I want to do is I want to give you the total experience.
Just one extra thing I did want to ask on, you know, in my world, I'm looking at numbers all the time and helping other businesses look at numbers.
Right.
With a restaurant business, we talked about the cost, but what about the numbers that you guys are looking at on a regular basis that is useful to you, whether that is obviously, you know, how much revenue is coming in every week or night. How do you typically look at that?
Well, everything has to be analyzed. You get a certain number that you're bringing in, and you analyze that number, and you see where all, you know, you break it up and you see where everything is going.
Yeah. Okay. So what are the ones you look at? Is it just literally revenue on a daily basis? Do you look at number of people coming in?
We look at number of people coming in. We look at what your food cost is, what your beverage cost is, what miscellaneous costs are, what back of the house costs are. so many different costs. But all those have to take, you know, all those take part into, at the end of the day, what you take home as profit.
One other area I kind of had to touch on, just again, with my background, I work in the technology space and I'm interested in it. How do you guys see technology, whether that is the internet or technology within the restaurant space itself? That's obviously changed in the years that you've been working in the space. So maybe we'll try, let's break that down into two. One is within the actual space itself, and one is the internet. So maybe let's take the space itself. How has that changed over the last few years?
I think everything has changed. I remember going to a restaurant that they would use pen and paper. And, you know, your check would come out and everything would be written there and you wouldn't understand a thing. And everything was so disorganized.
Yeah.
I remember opening up a, you know, I remember my parents opening up a restaurant that had no POS system.
Yeah.
And it was so difficult.
That's point of sale for people that
correct.
Don't. Yeah.
It was so difficult to maintain an understanding of what really went on in the business.
Mm.
But as far as the internet goes, the majority of our reservations were all made on the internet.
Yeah. So yeah, let's say the internet, because one part is reservations, but the other side is like reviews, you know, content sites like Eater and New York Times. Obviously, most people that I know that read that review read it online rather than the printed version.
Right.
So how did you guys?
Another thing, when it comes down to print, I think the majority of people are actually reading online more than print. Like I have a subscription to the New York Times.
Yeah.
I end up going online instead of getting the one I get at home, actually, is the one I throw out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I read it already online.
Yeah. So on the review side, how do you guys manage reviews? So like if, you know, this isn't just for Nakazawa, but just as a whole, because personally, like every time I go to a restaurant, like in fact, Nakazawa I probably heard about first because I saw it on Foursquare or Yelp or something like that. So, you know, and a lot of new places that I go to, I find through those apps and tools.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about them?
When you're looking at like Foursquare, Yelp, and so on, it allows everyone to be their own reviewer.
Yeah.
Okay. Not everyone is correct on their reviews. And unfortunately, don't get me wrong, Nakazawa gets a couple of bad reviews.
Yeah.
We look at them. We process them.
Mm.
We speak about it with the staff.
Yeah.
And if there is a real problem, we make sure that we fix that problem immediately.
Yeah.
And I hope everybody else does that too as far as a restaurant business.
Yeah.
But as far as Yelp goes and all these other companies that they create, I guess they're wonderful. I guess you get a good general idea of exactly the quality of a restaurant.
Yeah.
But then once again,
it's from
that could very well hurt a restaurant. Like, you know, my perfect analogy to all this is you come from Oklahoma. You've had pizza in Oklahoma, correct?
Yeah.
You're so used to it. You've eaten it for about 25 years. You are accustomed to thinking that pizza tastes like that.
Yeah.
You come to New York City, you try a classic, or you go to Italy and you try Neapolitan pizza. You say, this is not pizza.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah.
You just don't understand it.
So,
and then you give a bad review.
Well, that's the thing, and this is my personal take on it. I find them very useful, but some of my favorite restaurants have three and a half stars out of five on Yelp, which is quite normal, just because when you read the one-star reviews, there are so many one-star reviews of people like, my food came 12 minutes late. You know, something ridiculous. Like, I don't want that to be factored into my personal.
But in all honesty, if people like myself, I'm in the business and I understand it. And when I go to a friend's business, I'm honest about the experience that I'm having. And there's nothing wrong with telling an owner, this is the experience.
Mm.
And that's not being hurtful. That's being actually, you know, the owner benefits for that sort of information.
Yeah.
But to go online immediately after your dinner and write a one-star review?
Yeah.
What does that tell me? How many nights do you go home after dinner?
And write a review? I don't think I've written a review before.
Think I've written one review.
Yeah.
I don't think I've written one review.
I love the fact that it's there and the fact that anyone can have a voice to a certain extent.
Right.
But then there's also a need for, you know, if you want to call them experts, I guess.
Monitoring it?
I
definitely believe that it should be monitored.
Yeah. I meant, sorry, in terms of like Eater or New York Times or Vice, you know, Munchies, whatever. No, they have their own.
Yeah, those are different. We're speaking about a totally different animal, like Eater and so on, that's always keeping up with what's going on in this industry.
Yeah.
Is something that you definitely can appreciate. Because you turn it on, you see something going on, you're like, oh my God, I didn't know that.
That's what I mean.
On.
Yeah. So they're like the experts. That's what I mean.
Absolutely.
In their own
space. And I'm a big fan of Eater. I'm a big fan of Grub Street.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of The Times.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm a big fan of The Times. I love The Times.
I did want to just take a few minutes to get to know you a little bit better and ask you some random fun questions just to see how you think about things. You seem like a very driven guy and you've got several restaurants already. You're probably doing, hopefully, you know, pretty well financially, hopefully. What stops you from just stopping that and just, you know, relaxing, spending time with your kids?
Three young ladies at home, three little girls at home. I got to pay for college pretty soon.
Okay.
And that doesn't allow me to stop. No, I think I'm at a point in my life that I'm not ready to stop yet.
Yeah.
But they will be. Okay. And I'm going to be content.
Mm.
I don't want any more. I'm gonna be content. I'm going to have what I have. We're going to manage it well.
Mm.
And I'm going to, as I said to you, it's all about being content. At the moment, I'm not content.
Mm.
I'm young. There's a lot more of me. What am I going to do? Just stick around and do nothing?
But why do you think one day you will be content?
Everybody reaches that point of being content, of being happy and being finally fulfilled and saying, you know what? I've done it. I'm cool with it. I'm ready to go on a beach and just to relax and smoke a cigar. And that's it.
Okay, if I took you to the 14-year-old you and said you were in the position you are today, when you were 14, do you think you would have said, all right, that would be great. I could just hang out, chill out on the beach. Because I'm just discussing it, but I think most people I know, I've interviewed people on here that are almost billionaires, and they even said to me, I've still got a chip on my shoulder. I'm still trying to prove myself.
Yeah, but you know what?
And everyone's different.
I'm not looking to prove myself anymore.
Okay. That's a big point.
I'm truly not. I'm a very family-oriented individual. I love spending time with my kids. I love spending time with my wife. I love going away with them. There's going to be a point that I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
Everything, you know, what I do, it's different. This is a business that, you know, that wears you out.
Yeah.
Every day you have to be at the restaurant. Mm. Every day you need to make sure what's going on. Every day you need to be on top of it, because if you're not, it just doesn't work.
Yeah. Talking about that, what is your kind of daily routine like? What does that look like?
I'm up at 5:30, 6 o'clock every morning.
Okay.
And I go on the computer, I start doing paperwork. I'm at Nakazawa almost every day.
What paperwork are you doing every day?
I'm doing research. I'm doing bills.
Okay.
I'm looking at invoices. I'm looking at food cost. I'm looking at, you know, the information that my staff has sent me.
Mm.
And I'm always reviewing it. I'm constantly reviewing it to see if I find, like, you know, little errors and so on. But I get up. I have two espressos.
That every day?
Every day. I go to the gym early in the morning.
What do you do at the gym?
What do I do at the gym? I run every morning. I run about 4 miles at the gym.
Mm.
And I do my workout.
Do you do weights at all?
I do weights.
Like lifting? Like what?
I don't lift that much. I don't lift that much, but I'm at the gym for about 2 hours.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I'm at the gym about 2 hours.
You go every single morning?
Six days a week.
6 days a week. All right. That's impressive.
6 days a week. I'm also 30 pounds lighter than I was last year. But But going to the gym is not a form of just for me to, you know, look better.
Yeah.
I feel better because it decompresses all my thoughts for those 2 hours.
Yeah.
And that's why I go there, because after I'm there, I feel amazing and I get back to the grind.
Yeah. Do you go to the steam room or anything like that?
I love the steam room.
The amount of good ideas I've had in the steam room. I don't know what it is about that, but it's kind of like I don't know if you've ever meditated or done yoga or anything like that, but I've tried using some apps like Headspace, if you've heard of that.
You bring your phone into the steam room?
No, I don't. But once I had gone through using the phone, I'd built up enough, you know, experience to do it myself. And I find that the best place to just relax and not think about anything.
You can't stay that long in the steam room.
Yeah, like,
you know, there's a
15, 10, 15 minutes.
I stay about 10 minutes and then I'm gone. But get everything out of my system.
All right, so you go to the gym. You have two espressos.
I go on an empty stomach.
Okay.
Every morning on an empty stomach. I have two espressos. I go to the gym. I get back. I have a protein shake every day with a banana, a scoop of peanut butter, and a little bit of almond milk.
Nice.
All right. And that is my meal supplement. And then I have dinner at night. But then I get to work, and my day at work starts.
What do you eat for lunch here? Do you eat?
I don't eat lunch.
You don't eat lunch at all?
No.
That's really surprising.
I don't eat lunch.
That's great. Okay. Do you not get hungry? Have you always not had lunch?
Not really.
Is it since you've lost 30 pounds?
No, it's not since I've lost 30 pounds. I'm not hungry. I don't eat lunch. I have so many things on my mind that I need to do, and I can't stop for lunch. I stop for dinner. Don't get me wrong. I indulge.
Yeah.
I do what I need to do.
Yeah.
But lunch is not one of my, it's not a priority. So and you, the guys that hang around with me, yeah. they know what they do is they bring in their bag food because I don't have lunch.
Okay. Okay. So you, so sorry. So you get to the office, you start, and what time do you get here? To the restaurant.
I get here around every day, 11 o'clock. 11 o'clock, my day starts here at the restaurant.
And then again, you're working all day because this doesn't open until 5?
This doesn't open until 5. I'm not here for dinner service. I do stay once in a while, but I'm in the move of going to every restaurant, making sure that Chumley's is opening on time, making sure this is going on.
Okay. Just having a presence.
Correct. Not only a presence, I actually...
doing stuff.
I do a lot of stuff.
Why is that important to go, you know, you could easily probably hire someone to do that.
I can, but I enjoy doing it. I think the physical appearance of the owner always being there really does show that, you know, that you have your staff that is working for you. It shows that you really care and you're here.
Yeah. And then by the time you get to the evening, do you always eat at home?
I try to eat at home as much as I can, but there's nights that I do have meetings and I'm meeting with people and I tend to go to a restaurant and I
guess you need to go to restaurants if you've got a restaurant.
I'm sorry, yeah.
If you want to see what else is going on.
I rarely eat at any of my restaurants. Not because they're not good, it's just...
You've already eaten there, so you
would. No, it's not that. it would be like work. It would be basically sitting down at the dining room of Nakazawa or one of the other dining rooms and me focusing in on the rest of the guests.
Yeah.
And not... having my dinner. That makes relaxing. Sense.
You couldn't relax.
Couldn't relax.
What are some restaurants you like to go to in New York that you're a fan of?
Like last night I went to Momofuku Sambar. I had a meeting at
is that East Village?
East Village, yeah. 13th Street and 2nd Avenue.
Yeah.
So I went there, I had a steak. Mm. It was the, I had a ribeye and it was enough for four people. It was a dry aged ribeye. The amount of time that it was aged, no one knows, but it was a DeBraga cut. It was absolutely delicious. And that was my day. And I had the French fries that I just raved about and I was telling everybody here.
Do you guys all know each other? Like in the restaurant industry?
I get along well with David. I think David is a innovator. I think what he's done, it takes a great deal of courage to present, you know, food and the way he does it. But he just does it so elegantly also. Yeah. You know, he's very minimalistic and very simple. And if you walk into any of the restaurants, but the product that he's putting on the table is by far bar none.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
What's cool with him, because he's done, did he open, was it Fuku? Is that just the chicken
he's done
burger.
Fuku. I think that was a great step on his part.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, it's a, you know, he's using his own brand and switching things up a little bit.
You like Chick-fil-A or Fuku better?
I don't think I've ever had Chick-fil-A, you know?
I'm kidding.
I'm joking. The funny thing with Chick-fil-A, I hadn't heard of it until I moved here.
I actually looked into that franchise of Chick-fil-A.
It's pretty popular. People that like it love it.
It's a pretty I looked into it not thinking that I was opening. I didn't want to open one, but I wanted to see what was going on with it.
Actually, talking of franchise, so you've always opened up your own places with your own name and your own concept, or with Chumley's, you're taking an old concept and reinvigorating it.
Correct.
What do you think of the business model of actually just paying someone else for a franchise like Pizza Hut, like KFC, etc.?
Well, I remember having a conversation with probably one of the most talented chefs in the country. And I was really young and we were chit-chatting and I said, I'd love to do something with you. I would really, truly love to do something with you. And he said, listen, because you want to make money, open up a McDonald's.
Is that what he said?
He said that to me. And that really stood with me because I'm not saying McDonald's, but they're all franchises that are very, very profitable. And not everyone has the same vision. Like, we want to make a statement. We're here to create something that's going to be amazing and everyone is going to think about it for the next 10 years, hopefully, or the next 20 years. I'm not here only to make money.
Yeah.
Money is a great thing. I love making money. It allows me to do what I'd like to do.
Yeah.
But we're also here because we want to create something that people are going to appreciate.
Yeah.
And they're going to say, wow.
So what you kind of alluded to already, but what is motivating you? You said specifically that, you know, it's not just money, it's also creating something that you love. You know, longer run, that's within the restaurant business specifically, but longer run, is there anything else that's really driving you or you can see looking back has driven you?
I think looking back and leaving I don't know how big my legacy is going to be.
Yeah.
But I'll attempt in whatever amount of time I have left over to make it as big as I possibly can, to make the biggest statement that I could.
Yeah. Why is that important to you? I mean, I'm in the same boat as you, but I'm just curious, why is that important, you know, versus just existing and making living?
Because I don't think any of us want to just exist.
Yeah.
We want to be in someone's memory. We want to be thought about.
Yeah.
It's like someone that loves you. Do you just want to exist for them, or do you want to be loved by them?
Yeah. That makes sense.
You know?
Cool. Another thing I normally like to talk to people about on this show is the word success, because it's such a overused word and it means different things to different people. So if I was to say the word successful, are there certain people that stand out to you in your mind? It doesn't have to be people you know. It could be famous people or fictional people. It could be someone no one knows, like your family member. And the reason I ask that is because the second part to that question is, what makes them successful to you?
I think the word success has many different definitions, I think. But if I had to pick a person that I would admire and think that his success is something that I would like to have, it's probably, you know, I truly don't know. You know, I have a friend of mine that his name is Larry Foley.
Okay.
He's the CEO of a company called Bronson Point.
What do they do?
It's a hedge fund.
Oh, it's a hedge fund. Okay.
It's a hedge fund. And he's extremely, extremely successful in what he does. But what makes him even more successful, he's got 5 children and a beautiful wife that he takes everywhere.
Yeah.
And I like that idea of having your family behind you and your family always there pushing you forward. That's success.
Yeah.
It's when you could go home, get along with your wife and tell your wife what's going on. And her saying, you know what, honey, I'm really, really proud of you, but I can't wait until you open up that restaurant. I can't wait.
Yeah.
I want you to. And that's what we try to achieve at home. We try to create a balance, I would say.
What about if you're thinking of your hedge fund friend or other people in a similar vein, are there any common traits amongst those people that you've seen that, all right, all my friends or the people
we're consistent. We're consistent on what we do on a daily basis. We go in and we do what we need to do every day.
Yeah.
We don't stop. We don't get deterred by anything. We could fail on certain things. We could have certain obstacles, but we continue doing it.
Yeah. Do you remember the best piece of advice you ever got from someone?
I don't know. It's funny. Tom, what did I tell you today? What were we speaking about today?
And who's Tom, by the way? I don't
know. Tom is my best friend since I'm 13.
Oh,
actually, okay. No. I met him when...
Tom, you've been best friends.
I had to be 11. You had to be younger than that. And he's been around, and now he's one of my partners at Chumley's.
Oh, cool.
So,
hey, Tom.
But it's very different. You know, being Neapolitan, we have a proverb for almost everything.
Yeah, that's all.
You know? But it's a Neapolitan saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And my father used to tell me this all the time. Not my father. My grandfather used to tell me this all the time. And when I complained about everything that I was doing, because, you know, we tend to complain once in a while. We say, I can't believe the amount of work I need to do and so on. So my grandfather used to say in Neapolitan, you say, "Voliva bicicletta, mo pedalo." And what that meant in English is, you wanted the bicycle, now start pedaling.
Okay. That's great. That was a good one.
I told him that today. I was talking to myself. You wanted the bicycle?
Did you say?
My grandfather, yeah, I told him. I said, you know what? I got a little bit of my grandfather in me.
Okay, it was the bicycle Chumley.
But the idea behind it is you wanted all this.
Yeah, yeah.
You wanted all this? Now do what you need to do and let it work.
Yeah. Did you say it in English or Italian?
I told him in Italian, and then I said what it meant in
English. You speak
he understands Italian?
All right, cool. So it worked twice.
Married to a nice Italian young lady.
All right, cool.
Italian.
That was good. That was a good one. I like that. Cool. Well, we're just going to finish off in a second. I normally finish off with this quick fire word association game. Nothing to get you in trouble. It's just to kind of think about the first thing that comes to your mind sort of thing. what's your favorite restaurant in New York?
Isn't
Nakazawa.
No, it isn't Nakazawa, but I tend to go, and I think the most the best experience that I have is probably at my La Bernardin. I think it's just a great, you know, great environment, and the food is simple and minimalistic.
What's your favorite Japanese place in New York that isn't Nakazawa? Are there any others that are pretty good? I've heard you mention a few before.
I just actually went to, I've been to Masa. Masa is one of my favorites, but I also went to Onodera just recently, and it was really traditional.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. It was delicious. And would I go back? I would definitely go back. But once again, the environment is extremely serious.
Yeah.
I like it to be, as you can see, look at the way I'm dressed. This is how I come into work. I'm a little bit more relaxed.
Yeah. Cool. What's the best slice of pizza in New York? Because you're a proper New Yorker. And that's like what we could talk about for 3 hours.
Best slice of pizza.
Yeah, slice. And then we're going to go to best
I would have to say Brooklyn, DeFara.
All right. And what about the best pizza pie rather than a slice?
Pizza pie?
Yeah, like a whole... It might be the same place, but...
I don't think Joe's down the block is that good, but... which everybody would say.
I like Joe's.
You like Joe's?
I mean, it's like my local as well.
You gotta remember, I'm Neapolitan, so I like more of a Neapolitan style pizza. But if I had to get something, I would say, you know what... I don't know.
All right.
Leave that blank.
All right, cool.
That's a tough one.
Italian food or Japanese food? I think I know the answer, but you've got to check.
What do you think?
Italian.
You think so?
I mean, for you.
Why? Why do you say that?
Because for me, if someone asked me Indian, Pakistani food or something else, which I really like.
Huh?
Yeah, because it's like home-cooked food. It's like my mom's
food. I love Italian food.
All right.
I love Italian food.
All right, cool. Best food publication? Where it could be a website or a... Maybe not New York Times because that is too broad.
I think what I'm always on, that I'm always following is probably Eater.
Okay.
Always on Eater. Is it the most, I enjoy it, it's accessible, it's there.
Yeah.
I'm always reading it. Plus it really does.
They do a good job.
They do a great job, especially with New York City.
What's the worst job you ever had? Have you always done this? Have you ever had like a weird job? Like
I used to valet cars.
Okay.
I used to valet cars when I first got my license because I thought it was a good idea. And that was the worst job I've ever had because they stole a car from me.
They stole a car from me?
Correct. What had happened was they went in the box to John. I don't know, this was where I was living at the time, and I was young.
Yeah.
I was valeting all these cars, and it was really, really busy. And the keys were in, you know, the valet box.
Mm.
Right. So I turned around a minute and I saw this guy run in the valet box and grab the car and take off with it. I said, look at this cheap, miserable guy. I said, he didn't want to leave me a tip. So he had to go in the box again. People came out with the ticket. I said, oh, my God.
Oh, so someone
that was
stole the car.
Yeah. That was the worst.
Did you get fired?
Did I get fired?
Yeah.
It wasn't my fault.
Okay.
What was I supposed to do? Fight the guy?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's tough.
It's a tough one, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Best chef that isn't Nakazawa. That's a tough one as well.
That's a very, very tough one, and I can't say.
Even if we
said, I got to say, there's a whole bunch of talent out there that I definitely appreciate.
You could pick more than one, or, you know, a few that you think are doing a good job.
Like, I love Chang.
Yeah?
I do.
Okay.
I love Chang, and there's great chefs. It's not only David. David's the type of food that I like to eat. It's easy. It's minimalistic. It's simple. It's what I like.
Yeah.
It's what I like.
How did you guys meet?
I met him here at Nakazawa.
He came to eat?
I met him at Nakazawa. He sat down. I was introduced to him by a mutual friend, and we just hit it off. He's I must say, he was very helpful to me in the whole review process. And I used to call him up. He's like, Dave, what do you think? He's like, I don't know. But he's been great, and he's been a friend, and there's been a whole bunch of others that I haven't mentioned that have been also, you know, they've been there for me, and they're just great friends.
What makes you most happy? Got to switch it up a little bit, man.
No, I don't want to switch your toes. It up. I'm old school. What makes me most happy is my kids.
Your kids, all right.
My children make me the most happy. I love spending time with them, and now that they're growing and I see them growing and their personality is really expanding, that is something that makes me very happy.
Yeah. How many kids you have?
I have three. Three girls.
Three girls?
Yeah, I'm blessed. Oof.
That's great. last one for you, man. I had to finish off on a food one. If you had to eat one meal every day forever... What would it be?
One meal every day
meaning,
forever.
Yeah.
It'd be at the Sushi Nakazawa counter in front of Daisuke Nakazawa. Okay.
That's the only way to
finish
this.
That is the only way to finish that one.
Thanks, man. This has been awesome. I had a lot of fun.
It was my pleasure.
Great, man. Great to meet you. Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please share this with your friends. I'll be bringing you some incredible guests over the coming weeks. You can subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or any podcast app you're using. You can also subscribe to the email list on the website. Just go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. You'll be able to get every single episode, free giveaways, and exclusive content straight to your inbox. You can also listen to all the episodes on creatorlab.fm with all the show notes, books, links, any resources that were mentioned in the conversations. and please say hello. You can send me an email directly. That is hello@creatorlab.fm, or just find me on any social network. The username is creatorlabfm. I look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy.